Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
We did a couple of plays together, and we used to go to the O'Neill Playwriting Festival when we were younger, and like, I didn't know you could have dogs in here.
I know.
Must be
as long as the dog's vaccinated. Yeah. This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. When I still lived in New York, I frequently ate at a diner at the corner of 6th Avenue and Waverly Place in Manhattan, just a few blocks up from WNYC's offices. And I was back there a couple of weeks ago with Annabelle, one of our producers.
Hello.
Hi, how you doing? It's going to be three of us, but we're still waiting on our third person. Can we sit down or
should
we wait?
Yeah. May I have a buttons card, right?
Vaccine cards weren't the only thing that was different than the last time I was here. Between the lines of booths are plexiglass barriers, and everyone working was wearing masks. But the restaurant did still have real menus instead of QR codes, those oversized diner kind, a dozen pages long or so, in plastic sleeves. Annabelle and I were at the Waverly Diner to meet actor J. Smith Cameron. You may know her from the HBO show Succession. She plays Jerry, general counsel for a multi-billion dollar media conglomerate who's the only adult in the conference room. She takes care of business while everyone around her acts like a maniac. In person, Jay comes off as warm and chatty and not even a little bit cutthroat.
Hi.
I'm so scared I'd be late. How are you guys?
Good. I'm Anna.
Hi, Anna.
Hi.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. I'm so excited to do this with you.
Yeah, me too. I'm so curious why you picked me.
Because you're interesting.
I'm so fascinated.
Yeah.
Jay lives in the neighborhood. We'd suggested meeting at the Waverly Diner after noticing she posted a picture of their egg cream on her Instagram. I think of that as a very New York thing to order. But Jay grew up in Greenville, South Carolina, and moved to Manhattan in her early 20s. She has spent her entire life since then performing. Before Succession, Jay was on another critically acclaimed TV show, Rectify. But a lot of her work hasn't been on screen, but on stage, on and off Broadway, where the audience is right there, breathing the same air as her. All that went away with the pandemic. And that was a big part of what I wanted to talk with her about, what the last 18 months has been like for someone whose work depends on being around other people, and how reentry's been going for her. And this was a reentry for me, too. This was one of my first in-person interviews since the pandemic. And you can tell that I was a bit anxious and overexcited. You'll hear me as we talk, breaking in awkwardly, like a little terrier.
You've been in this neighborhood for a long time.
I have, yes. I've been in and out of this neighborhood from the very beginning. My first apartment I moved in with a college chum on Grove Street until she kicked me out because it was really not big enough for two people. And then I moved back for a while on West 4th Street and then moved away and then Kenny, who I eventually married.
That's Kenny as in Kenneth Lonergan, the Oscar-winning writer and director. They've been married for over two decades.
Play, the Waverly Gallery.
Uh-huh.
And so we lived there for, I don't know, a long time, you know, and we recently moved down to Soho, but still basically the same zip code, so.
And when you come into the Waverly Diner, like, is this a place that you have spent a lot of time?
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. My best friend, who passed away about 3, going on 4 years ago, although it still seems like horribly fresh, his name's Kevin Gere, he's an actor, and we were very close, and we would just kill time. I mean, it was, this is a little, I'm carrying with me a chapter from James Joyce's Ulysses.
Do you know what you want to order?
Yeah.
We can order, we can pause for a minute, and then we'll go back to Ulysses.
Oh, well, I don't have much to say. Hi, I'll have a chocolate egg cream.
Chocolate egg cream, okay.
I'd like an omelet. I'd like a peppers, onion, and feta omelet, please.
And feta cheese, right?
Yes, okay. Yeah. Thank you. And egg cream, is this something you get?
Well, I do love an egg cream. Which I don't know why they call them. There's neither egg nor cream in it, as far as I understand.
So what's in it?
You know, we should Google it. Have you had one before?
No, I think I should order one
taste. I definitely think we should. Although we do have another straw. That seems a little COVID.
Yeah, I know. So you're carrying this around, chapter of Ulysses.
Yes. My point was about how he writes about Dublin. You know, he'll just, like this thing kind of wandering around and running into people and just losing a sense of time.
Yeah.
And like, so for actors, it's not, I don't have very much to say about Ulysses.
Okay.
except this chapter that I'm reading is sort of makes me think of how Kevin and I used to be. Because when we're between gigs and we're just auditioning, actors have a lot of time to fill without trying to fall into a desperate void in your mind, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And Kevin was just this great, he was a little bit older than me and he had started like off Broadway in the era when all that was really new, and he knew all these people and had kind of, he just had a fascinating life, and he was one of these really observant people and had incredible memory. So we would come in this diner and you know, nurse a cup of tea and a corn muffin for many hours. And
what did he die of?
I don't know. I think some heart thing. It was a sudden death in his home. So
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you.
So are you carrying around this just for your own? is this, are you
just
reading?
It just makes me look intellectual. Yeah. No, my husband printed out this chapter for me because of something that he's working on that this sort of somewhat inspired him.
So was that like, I'm thinking about this thing that's inspiring me and I want you to read it so we can talk about it?
Well,
kind of thing?
I don't know. He mentioned it some time ago, and I said, oh, I want to read that chapter. And then just as a gift, he'd print it out for me. I don't think. I was just curious.
You expressed interest.
Yeah. And I could have just picked up the book, but he kindly.
Yeah, that's a nice gesture.
Very nice.
I heard you were interested. Yeah.
Yeah. So I thought, I have, after our talk, I have to go to the doctor, and I might have a waiting room wait. So I thought this is a perfect thing to have with me.
And when have you found that you get that itch that you're like, I'm going to go to the diner. I'm going to walk down and go to the diner.
Well, I have to tell you, too, that my daughter, who's now 19, this was her favorite spot to meet friends from middle school on. And so when she, you know, that time when kids begin to do things without their parents and, you know, like, this was a place she could walk to. It was, you know, really popular for a place to go for a burger. And so I have also those associations. And when she was younger than that, like, picking her up after school and if she was starving and maybe with another mom and another kid coming in here, piling into a booth. And so I also have those associations.
It's interesting for me that like this has been a place where you sort of like it's you came of age, like, in this neighborhood, you know, and you've had a lot of different life phases, both in this physical place and then walking these streets.
Yeah.
And it's like now I'm thinking about you sitting with Kevin and how that's sort of like, it's like a, it's a memory that can't happen anymore when your daughter was young. And that's a memory
that's
that can't happen anymore. And it's all sort of in, was in this space.
Yeah, exactly.
How many times have you been here since COVID?
I have been in here, like when I come in from Long Island, I usually do come here. So I have, I don't know, they ask for the, all the restaurants here do that.
Yeah.
They ask to see your vaccine, you know, records, and I don't know, I feel safe here.
What's your routine like right now in this time of early fall in New York? Are you mostly in the city? Are you still going back to Long Island?
Going back and forth a lot. We just bought a home out there. So, but it's also pre-succession premiere, so I'm doing a lot of press for Succession.
Yeah.
So I have to be in a lot for things like that.
So,
and also, you know, getting, Nellie's getting ready for school or just whatever she needs, or she's really doing it all herself, but just, I mean, it's one thing to go off to college, but to go off to college in a foreign country after a pandemic. This is something interesting. I don't know. It's off topic maybe, but.
Thank you.
Nellie was a senior when the pandemic hit.
Mm-hmm.
And in Nellie's case, she didn't have her, I mean, I don't even know if she was the type of kid who would go to the prom, but like they didn't get to have their prom or their graduation or perform their spring play or, I mean, all these rites of passage, you know? And so I think this really drives it home, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When you have, like for that initial lockdown, when we're all three together, in some ways, it made us all closer. In other ways, you know, like probably every other family, we all wanted to kill each other.
Yeah.
So when we, what happened is after the first month or two of COVID, we rented out in Long Island so that we'd have a little bit more space and have some outdoor space.
Yeah.
And that's when we started like letting Nellie, you know, she graduated from high school and we started letting her have more alone time. So that alleviated that. But at first, you know, we all had that cabin fever.
Like,
That,
what was the what were the rules for when you were on Long Island and your daughter was here in your apartment? Did you have strict rules
for her? Well, you know, we could tell ourselves there were rules, but who knows what happened if these walls could speak, kind of thing. I don't know. I mean, like, I'm sure it was party at Nellie's a lot, but the house is still standing.
Okay, good.
There's nothing broken that I know of. There's maybe less vodka in the vodka bottle. I don't know. I don't know who did that. That might have been me. No, she's been very adult and responsible. And, you know, she has a nice friend group.
Are you feeling, like, how are you feeling about this stage of motherhood? Do you feel like the year of your daughter being here and beginning school was sort of like a drawn-out transition? Or does it feel like you were able to, in denial about her leaving home? Like, how did it work out for you?
Well, a little of both, definitely. Yeah. I'm sure I'm in denial about it.
Yeah.
But it was a sort of practice for us to, you know, to sort of live apart a lot of the time. And I think, I'm not sure, I'm sure it will still, like, be a huge emotional slam when she's over there. And I don't, like, if she's like every other teenager who goes away to college, she will not be texting or calling particularly unless she needs money or something. So I'm trying to, you know, wrap my head around that. But the other thing is, you know, my husband, we were in Italy filming for Succession the last couple of episodes. And then my husband was, he was in Italy as a jurist in a, or a president of a jury maybe for a film festival. So he kind of just started like drifting around Italy and writing. So we were in Siena together, we were in Florence together, and briefly in the, out in the country in Tuscany together.
Yeah.
I thought I turned this off. Sorry.
That's a funny ringtone.
It's Bewitched.
I know.
sorry about that.
That's
and my
okay.
text alert is the is Samantha's Twitch.
Oh,
I thought I turned it off. I guess I turned it on. So that's bad.
So you had this extended, and this was just, and your daughter was not there. So, or were you, when you were in Italy with your husband?
Yes, that's
having
right.
this time working, and then you're meeting up in Europe, and he's working, and like.
But he had this sort of, what I was getting towards is that he had this sort of feeling like, oh, we could do this now because our daughter won't be in school in New York City. We don't have to be tied to the city. So there's really nothing to hold us here the same way that we have been bound here when we had a school-age child, you know? Uh-huh.
That's sort of, I was assuming a kind of grief for you, and I also hear you saying, when you use the word bound, there's an expansion that comes with this transition, too, for like for you both in your marriage.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of it that way.
Yeah.
Coming up, how Jay's years of honing her craft in the theater have helped her on the set of Succession, and when she's had to let go of that entirely.
We often feel like we weren't enough on Succession. Like, all of us often feel that. Like, and it's never true. When you see the show, it's all, everyone seems good on it, to my eye. But there's a lot of, like, you know, it's sort of like, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. There's a lot of that. Forget it, it's, it's Succession. Like, it's messy, and that's one of its virtues.
As a team, we've been talking a lot lately about bodies and our relationships, specifically about physical size and how it shapes our romantic lives. Our intern, Sarah Dealey, brought this up in a recent editorial meeting. And Sarah, I just wanted to talk with you a bit about where that idea came from for you. Why did you bring this up?
Hi, Anna. I have been thinking about this a lot. I am fat and my girlfriend is not. And I think that the fact that we have these differences has really impacted our relationship in a lot of interesting, complicated, and a lot of times really positive ways.
And for you all, is this something that you all speak openly about, that you have you named this difference between you two?
Yes, definitely. And like the fact that we talk so much about how each other's bodies move through the world and are perceived by other people has just, I think, made it easier for us to go through other challenging things as a couple. So I want to hear from other people who have similar situations in their relationships. I'd love to hear from fat people who are in relationship with thin people, fat people in relationships with other fat people, just about how weight has impacted your intimate relationships and if it's like changed anything else about the relationship.
And speaking of change, that's the other thing I'm interested in, because of course our body sizes change over time, can change over time. So we also want to hear from people who maybe you or your partner has a different body size than you had when you first got together, when your relationship started. And I want to hear about how you figured out how to communicate about that or not. So that's what we're collecting, stories about body size in your romantic relationships, how you've talked about it and how you've not talked about it. You can record a voice memo or write an email and send it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thanks. I'm excited to look through the inbox.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Do you ever feel like there's nothing new in the news? You know there are urgent things happening in the world around you, but all you hear is noise. That's why we made What Next. Our goal is to tell you the stories you haven't heard before, or maybe a different side to the story you thought you already knew all about. I'm Mary Harris, the host of What Next, and I love my job because it helps me cut through the noise of the news. And then I get to bring it to you. Together, we can figure out what next.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles. But for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com. From the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking try free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click try free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks. This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. When Succession premiered in 2018, Jay Smith Cameron was not expecting it to be a hit. She wasn't even expecting to be a series regular. Her role as Jerry, the general counsel, was originally written for a man. But Jerry became a fan favorite, especially after an unexpected twist last season. Her relationship with Roman, the much younger son of her uber-wealthy employer, turned a little bit spicy. Roman is played by Kieran Culkin.
You're acting like an overexcited little boy.
You know, technically, I'm your fucking boss.
Go to bed, Roman. Go to bed and masturbate all your ideas out. And let's see how excited you feel tomorrow.
Well, maybe. Maybe I will. I mean, maybe I'll just leave you on the pillow so you can hear my brilliance cascading.
Fine. I've heard plenty worse than a spoiled brat ejaculating on himself.
Oh, yeah?
I've known Kieran Culkin since he was really young.
Yeah.
We were in a play together. We were in Margo together. He's been in other Kenny shows. And I don't... He's sort of still 20-something in my mind, and yet he's also my age in my mind. And, of course, he's neither of those things. So he's an example of, like, I don't know, maybe it has to do with being an actor or being friends with other actors, that they're kind of ageless.
Yeah. My idea of your career has been that you have had a full life of performing and being exposed to interesting creative people, but... Succession has catapulted your public image and your face
into broader consciousness, you might be. Are you experiencing a loss of privacy since Succession in a way that you haven't experienced before?
Not that much, because really COVID,
kind of,
and then, and now when we're out and about, we have a mask on, and I don't actually look that much like Jerry. I mean, I'm dressed like Jerry. I don't particularly look like Jerry. Once in a while, someone will be like, is it you? But no, it's a little surreal, but it's a little, I don't quite have the sense of that. Like, I have to remind myself that that's the case. So what's incredible about Succession is that you have to think and pay, you know, keep up. It's very plotty, but it's also all the characters' struggles are sort of layered in, and you kind of, the audience has a kind of work to keep up with it. And I think that makes, that's a secret sauce for something to be successful. But the formula for TV is like, make everything accessible and everybody, you know, and you know, all the leads have to look like models, and and so, and I don't think people actually like that. I think they like things to be interesting and you know, have nooks and crannies to them. So,
did the way that you, I've seen you reference people watching as a, something that's informed the way you think of performance and acting.
Definitely.
And like, did you notice the sort of closing off of access to public, you know, and then the reopening? Like, are you super sensitive to it now because you haven't had that input for a while, just as a working person?
I feel like we don't quite have it
because
of the masking and the social distancing. And I'm not going out to see things as much. Like, I'm happy that some of my friends are getting to do plays again, but I don't even know if I'm nervous about going into a theater and watching for that long, even if the seats are spaced out and everyone's vaccinated and so forth. I'm still a little wary of it, to be frank. And Kenny's very wary of it. He has an elderly stepdad who he's protective of, so he just does not want to carry COVID into that household when he goes to see him. And you know, so I still feel like there's a dearth of that. But yeah, you're right. I'm really into that. I feel like that's a huge, that observing people is a huge boon for actors or writers. Like, I used to love the subway for that.
Yeah,
because you just sit there and like somehow there's this pact where everyone sort of behaves like they're alone.
Yeah, not paying attention.
They can't be seen, you know? Yeah. As if they're all in little private invisible booths. Like, if there's a, just an accepted convention that you're sort of privately sitting there. So if you, if someone catches you staring at them, studying them, it's very upsetting to that person. But I do like that. I really, and you know, I've been, I really want to take this class that Linda Barry, do you know who Linda Barry is? She's a cartoonist.
I don't think so.
Writer.
Okay.
And she's fantastically gifted, very funny. And she teaches a class, and she has, I think she, I want to say she has a blog or something. She's on Instagram. You can follow her on Instagram. The Nearsighted Monkey is the name of her.
Okay.
And she has, but you can see online some of, she teaches what must be this incredible course, but some of her, her syllabus is online, or you can see it in some of her books. And one of her assignments that she has all her students do is a diary from the, you try to remember, you time yourself, so you only have a couple minutes, everything you remember from yesterday, and then a separate task, another 2 minutes, just everything you remember seeing, every visual image you saw. And then I saw the same exercise in another place where she had added onto it something, one thing you overheard. And then eventually you make a little sketch of the thing that was overheard, but you put yourself in the drawing.
Yeah.
So, and you don't have to be, you know, it's not, it's, you have a minute or two to draw. It's nothing to get self-conscious about. You just try to get, make your point.
Yeah.
And it's the thing you witnessed, but also your reaction. You know? So it's a, I don't always, I'm not as disciplined. Like, she would drum me out of that class in no time, because she, apparently you can't be late, or you can be late once or something, and she kicks you out. So I can't even, you know, do the diary every day, but I aspire to that.
That idea right of like having a sort of method for forcing yourself to be observant and to capture it.
If you can train yourself to be observant, you will never be bored. You will never, I mean, it's a great tonic for an artist, because it keeps you from being sentimental, because people behave admirably and embarrassingly all the time. You know, like, people are human, and if, the more you witness real people being real, And that's why I think my taste for acting and writing, I like realistic
messy
stuff, because yeah, I think it traps you into getting more deeply involved. There's less of a barrier between what you're watching and
yeah,
and yourself. Like you're not, if something's so real that you forget you're watching artifice, yeah, or if it's so familiar to you, if it's so, you know, that's so engaging. Like that's when you
yeah
kind of step in the trap of it and you get caught in up in it. I think that's everything for me. I love that.
I just love how you said it's a tonic for artists because it keeps you from becoming sentimental.
Yeah.
That like becoming sentimental is this hazard
yeah
for artists.
Well, don't you think? I mean, that one of many,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. But, no, I love that. It's like, no, you're over-emoting. Like,
yeah,
you got to complicate
this. Or
just
look this how real people
yeah
behave in
yeah
situations. It always surprises you, even though you see it every day of your life. Like,
yeah,
there's an apocryphal acting story. I don't know who it's supposed to be, who the teacher's supposed to be, but this famous, so supposedly a famous acting teacher had written out a transcript of a everyday family having dinner. And they have, you know, a discussion about like all kinds of banal everyday things.
Yeah.
And they, you know, pass the pepper. Or I like, you know, I like the way the casserole turned out or whatever.
Yeah.
So she wrote this out, or he wrote this out verbatim, divided up his class into family casts, assigned it. And then they performed them. And apparently the story goes that, you know, cast after cast knocked themselves out being, you know, muttering and being boring and throwing everything away, and the things that were banal being really, you know,
yeah,
boring. And
flat.
Then he, at the
yeah
end of the whole thing, he played the recording that he'd taken, uh-huh, the transcript. And it was like, oh my God, can you believe the price of tomatoes? And like, oh my God, did you see her? How much she's grown? Like, you know, people were far more dramatic and
yeah
animated, but they were real.
Yeah.
They were the real people. They weren't performing.
And the content of their words didn't contain at all how they were expressing care for one another and interest.
Yes,
like,
and
it
passion.
Was just like, yeah.
Like, yeah.
Oh,
so,
I, like that.
I mean, that's just a good, it's not always true for every scene, but,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of a good cautionary tale,
uh-huh,
I think. And I just think that's a good guide. Like, when I'm stuck, I'm like, well, what would you do? And so, you know, instead of thinking, well, I'm not really, you know, a lawyer, and I'm not really a business, I don't know anything much about business at all, and et cetera, you know, et cetera. But just the situation, like, so how, like, for instance, in Succession,
mm-hmm,
when the storyline between Jerry and Roman began,
mm-hmm,
I really had no idea how Jerry would feel about it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had a few ideas, but it was so perplexing. And then it just dawned on me that that's perfect, that that would be perplexing for her, too.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah
that is always going to be more interesting, is what would a real person do? It's like
yeah
a good place to start, rather than deciding that she was a dominatrix
yeah
or that she was going to seduce
him. If you're thrown by it,
have
the character be thrown.
Interesting. Yeah, like,
uh-huh,
and that's, you know, pretty much always true, I think. I mean, for my tastes, mm-hmm, let's say that.
I want to go back to where we started with thinking about your conversations with Kevin.
Yeah.
When you think about that time of your life when you're learning how to deal with downtime and uncertainty, and the, like, as you're in this moment of transition in your own family life right now, like, I'm thinking that a lot of us, as you were describing, are in that, like, start and stop and what's going to happen and inability to sort of see concretely what the future is going to be in 2 months or 4 months. And,
yeah,
and
which is always true for actors.
Yeah. So,
do,
like, what have you learned when you feel that creeping sense of, like,
anxiety?
Anxiety.
Yeah.
Do you have any practices or things that you try to tell yourself?
Well, that remains a, you know, a big occupational hazard for people in my business. Like,
yeah,
that is a really tricky thing. I don't know if there
and
is
probably
a
in living
and for everyone, right?
Yeah.
But it's just sort of very patently obvious for
mm-hmm
performers.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess, you know, I mean, the real truth of it is, it's only always this moment.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I know that's a big philosophical idea too, mm-hmm, but it really is true that if you're just in the present, there's no remorse or longing for the past or fear of the future. It's just you're. So it's impossible to do, but that's also a big acting, famous acting,
mm-hmm,
you know, dictum, is
mm-hmm
to be in the moment and be
mm-hmm
present. And if you try to practice that as a kind of mindfulness or just as an acting exercise, just being in the moment,
when I'm nervous about remembering my lines, which happens a lot, or nervous about anything on set, but I get nervous as a performer a lot about all kinds of things. If I just put my focus on my partner, even if it's I'm just watching how often they blink or what, you know, are they preoccupied about something or why does he keep looking over there? Like, you know, just so it's the observation exercise again in another guise, really. That's what I strive for, is to just try to be occupied fully with what I'm doing now. And like Kenny, one of Kenny's first jobs, apparently, like way before I knew him, before he was a famous writer, before he was a writer at all, he was a bartender for a while. But, you know, he said the thing that someone taught him about being a bartender is to do one task at a time, which is, for a bartender, always being invaded and, like, something gets spilled over, someone shouts out a drink order, somebody sends something back right in the middle, or a waitress needs to get by, or whatever. And he said, you just have to make yourself finish the thing you were doing and then go, okay, now. And, and that's just sounds so obvious. But
it's hard.
And it's not only is that myth of multitasking a demon to avoid, I think, to expect that of yourself, but it also can be a cure for the blues or for anxiety, I think, to just fully, you know, throw yourself into, but I mean, easier said than done sometimes. I'm not like some great master at it by any means.
I have one last question. I am just curious, you said your place on Long Island is new, and when you think about, you know, having had this very full, stimulating, active, crowded life in this part of New York City, when you think about what you're looking forward to in that space, and like what seems really exciting about getting to spend more time there, is there like a hobby that you're interested in?
Well,
or
I swim a lot during the warm weather, and there's the ocean, there's the bay, and there's swimming pools out there, so that is the obvious easy answer. But also, it's, you know, I mean, it's in the Hamptons, and the Hamptons are really now a suburb. But
it doesn't feel uncrowded.
It doesn't. It's still filled with natural beauty. Like, it's a very beautiful, lush place. And, you know, like, my husband grew up in the city, and he would love to just leave it all behind. Like, he is, it's so funny. Like, and I am the person, I think the, you know that famous E.B. White essay about New York? And about the people, the three basic people types that make up New Yorkers. And but the people that migrated here, the writer with the manuscript in his newspaper, or the spinster who wants to, is seeking anonymity or whatever. Remember?
Thank you.
That those are that's the quotient of the population that give New York its energy and light and
hunger. You know,
the beat of it. I think among my friends, that like Kevin was definitely someone who migrated here. And if you're an actor or any artist or in any creative type position and you come to New York, just that action alone is a huge achievement. It's so bold. It's so brave to do it. And it's a heroic journey. Like, you've done that, and you know in the back of your mind that you did. That's a big rite of passage that native New Yorkers don't get to feel that, I don't think. So it's a weird, it's hard, and you feel lost, and you don't know if you'll ever belong there or may have a niche. But it's a great benefit. You know, it's a great blessing to have in the end, to have, because that alone, like, anything else is gravy. Like, I came here.
That is Jay Smith Cameron at the Waverly Diner in the West Village. You can see her on the latest season of Succession, which just started on HBO.
Thank you. To be continued.
Yes.
That's how I think. Thank you so much.
It's really a pleasure.
Bye.
Bye.
Oops. Take care. Okay.
That Sex and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Annabelle Bacon. The rest of our team includes Katie Bishop, Afi Yellowduke, Emily Botine, and Andrew Dunn. Our intern is Sarah Dealey. The Reverend John Delure and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Instagram at AnnaSalePix, that's P-I-C-S, and the show is at Death Sex Money on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you to Sarah Dacey in Austin, Texas, who is a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money. Join Sarah and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. And for the record, before we left, Jay and I did Google the ingredients of an egg cream. It's 3 tablespoons of chocolate syrup mixed together with 1/4 cup of milk. You beat that together while adding club soda to fill up the glass. Add a straw and serve cold. I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.